You have to wait. Somebody's talking already. Joanne, what are you? Oh, here we are. Here's Michael. That's just a screenshot.
But we can't hear it. That's what I don't understand. Oh, God.
Computer audio?
I keep clicking on it. She's one of the audio.
Hey, you guys need to find the mute button.
Okay.
There you
we're just going to wait a couple minutes. Start. Ross, I know. Then I see.
Ten off.
Ten off. Okay, we'll start the class now. So the goal today for Yom Kippur, the class of Yom Kippur, is to is twofold. Number one, we're going to try to understand the essence of how we celebrate Yom Kippur, what we get out of Yom Kippur, what we're supposed to focus on in Yom Kippur. And the second thing is we're going to try to glean from the message of Yom Kippur a principle that we could use in our own lives, our daily lives, when it comes to relationships, especially the relationships that are most important to us. So when you analyze Yom Kippur, you have to ask yourself, what does it mean, Day of Atonement? What is Yom Kippur all about? We explain Rosh Hashanah as being the day in which a person can define themselves and their potential for the year. And when I give my Rosh Hashanah class, I always get people saying to me, well, what else do we want? Why do I come to Shul Yom Kippur on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? You come to Shul Yom Kippur, just have a good year. Good year ahead. A year of which I get everything I want. You know, like God's a vending machine. We have to use the vending machine God to get the things we want out of God for the year. I pray for health. I pray for sustenance. For success. And that's what we get on Yom Kippur. I get on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is a day in which we're sort of recreated as human beings, a day which our potential is set for the year. And I feel like when you finish Rosh Hashanah, you already have what you need. And the Rambam actually seems to support this idea. Look at number one. I don't know if we can have people on Zoom to speak. If someone could read, someone could volunteer to read on Zoom and see if that works. Number one, by the way, does everyone have access to the source sheet?
I don't think I do.
I can read number one. I have it.
Okay, so the source sheet, it should be should have been emailed to everybody, but if you didn't get the email, it should be on the page with the class is listed on the website on a High Holiday page. I think should be a link there to the source sheet. You guys want?
I got an email today with that. If that helps anyone, some other people. I know other people might have also gotten emails.
Who want to read number one? Mike,
I can do it. Just as a person's merits and sins are weighed at the time of his death, so too the sins of every inhabitant of the world, together with his merits, are weighed on the final festival of Rosh Hashanah. If one is found righteous, his verdict is sealed for life. If one is found wicked, his verdict is sealed for death. A Benoni's verdict remains tentative until Yom Kippur. If he repents, his verdict is sealed for life. If not, his verdict is sealed for death.
So this is the famous concept which we read in Masechta Tokef. Rosh Hashanah Yechaseimim, Yom Kippur Yechaseimim. On Rosh Hashanah it's written, and Yom Kippur it's sealed. But this puts an entirely different twist on it. It seems from here, if you read it carefully, you see that the Rambam says that most people, most stuff for most people is decided already in Rosh Hashanah. If someone's verdict is a tzaddik, or a tzaddik, so they come out, then they're sealed for life. They're sealed for life. It's not written for life, it's sealed in Rosh Hashanah. Someone's evil, they're sealed for death. And someone's a Benoni. What's a Benoni? A Benoni is someone in the middle. So if you look early in the Rambam says that every person has merits and demerits, he says. And if someone's 50-50, exactly 50-50, they're Benoni. So what are the chances the person's abandoning? Very small. I mean, see, unless it's some reason that this calculation is done differently than he says, how is it possibly 50-50? I mean, it's almost impossible. So basically, for most people, Rosh Hashanah is the end. And even for abandoning, if you notice, the only thing that could change is life or death based on whether he did tshuva or not. But his status as abandoning remains. It doesn't change because of Yom Kippur. basically 99.9% of everything is decided according to the Rambam on Rosh Hashanah. So we have to understand what is going on with Yom Kippur. What's happening here? So one thing that I think it represents a lot of the concept of 10 days of tshuva is a mission Perkei Avos, which is number 2. If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? But not for others, what am I? And if not now, when? So what does it mean if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? I think there's a beautiful mission that really summarizes 10 days of repentance, the first tshuva. That if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? That's Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is a day we don't mention sin. We don't mention anything to do with a relationship with God. We mention all that happens to Rosh Hashanah is a day in which I could create myself in my mind. Yom HaZikaron is a memorial day. It's a day that works in my mind, in which I could envision the perfect person that I am. Perfect me. And God will give you potential for that perfect person that you are. Meaning, I want to be perfect on Rosh Hashanah. I don't want to mention sin. Arizal says, I can't even mention the word sin in that davening. We want to mention our faults. I want to be for myself. I want to create myself. I want to create the kind of person I want to be for next year. But Yom Kippur adds to Rosh Hashanah as the concept of relationship. That if only by myself, then I'm nothing. Right? If I am not for others, who am I? What am I? That means I don't engage in relationships. I'm just by myself. And that's not enough. It's not enough. I need to engage in relationships in order to live life to the fullest, properly. And therefore, Rosh Hashanah cannot be the whole story. Rosh Hashanah must be the means to an end. It's yourself that is necessary to engage in relationship. Because without yourself, you can't choose. And without choices in a relationship. So Rosh Hashanah, I have the power of choice. As the Rambam says in the Tshuva in Parak Hamish, in the fifth parak, he says that we have, human beings have Rosh Hashanah, have choice. And then he ends Hilchos Tshuva with, we'll see later, with the Avodah Me'ava, serving God of love, which means love is founded on choice, and choice is founded on relationship, on self. So Rosh Hashanah, the self that we created Rosh Hashanah, has a choice to make. What am I going to do with that self? The choice that you can make is relationship. You can't force someone to love you. God can't force us to love him. So he can't put a gun to our heads and say, love me or I'll kill you. I mean, there's no such thing. Love is based on choice. So Rosh Hashanah is a day in which we develop ourselves. We receive our potential for our own individuality, our own selfhood. And we use that gift that we receive in Rosh Hashanah to then choose out of our own free will, using ourselves to choose relationship with God. And we can, without self, you can't choose relationship with God. God will be forcing us to love him otherwise. So choice is vital for relationship, and Rosh Hashanah is therefore vital for Yom Kippur. Now, the source of Yom Kippur is not Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah really is historically nothing to do with Yom Kippur. Historically, the source of Yom Kippur is Shavuot Sabbat Tammuz, 17th of Tammuz. 17th of Tammuz is the day in which we violated the terrible transgression of the Chayka Egel, this golden calf. The golden calf sin was after Shavuot. We received the Torah on Sinai, 40 days later, we worshiped the golden calf. Shavuot is founded on Pesach. So if you think about it, the calendar is really a flow of experiences that Jews had in history. And basically, I think what's going on over here in the calendar is that we go through basically life experience in every year. We go through a cycle of life experience every year, and there's a deliberate order to that life experience. So, for example, Pesach is the beginning of the calendar in many ways. Specifically because Rabbi Yeshua says in Maseches Megillah, Maseches Rosh Hashanah, that Pesach is, Nisan is the beginning, is creation of the world. The world is created in Nisan. So what happened on Rosh Hashanah? So we explain Rosh Hashanah is a day, memorial day. It's a day in your mind. God created the world, puts Rabbi Elazar in Tishrei. But Rabbeinu Tam explains that Rabbi Elazar is trying to say that God created the world in his mind, in his mind. And he created b'maisa, in action, in actuality, created the world in Nisan. So we celebrate Tishrei as the creation of the world. It's really Hayom Harat Olam. It's a day of the thought of God in the world. It's conception of the world. Conception in English means the same thing as in Hebrew. It's triple meaning. It means the beginning, it means the creation, it means the conception. The conception in thought. Conception in birth and conception of thought. So basically the conception of the world, Hayom Harat Olam, is the day that God created the world with his mind, whatever that means. So when God created the world, in actuality, it was Nisan. So Nisan is the beginning of the cycle. Nisan starts with freedom. Freedom then goes to success. We were successful in reversing the curse of Adam at Mount Sinai. But something that counts as failure. Failure is something that everyone goes through in life. We go through freedom, success, failure. We go from failure to Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the day of Avelut. Avelut means acceptance. We accept the failure. We sit down on the ground and we don't fight anything. We just accept the fact we failed. That leads to Nechama. Nechama means, Nechama is basically the word Vayinacham is always used to change your mind, changing your mind. So it's a transition to changing our mind from acceptance to failure. That leads to Tshuva, which is 10 days of Tshuva, which is, has to do with a change changing of yourself. Recreating yourself in a sense, and that's really Rosh Hashanah. And Yom Kippur is a day that we engage in relationship. That means it's a day of love. Day we choose love out of our own free will. That we basically recreation that we see the Rosh Hashanah. That leads to Sukkot, which is happiness, and then Shmini Atzeres, which is a separate holiday, and that's Shlemut. That's fulfillment. That's completion. That's a peace or completion. That leads to the winter, which is death, and then the spring, which is rebirth. So that's we go through that cycle the whole year because this is a microcosm of all of life experiences that we go through. And we'll focus on the transition from failure to avilut, which is acceptance, and then the chaban, which is change, and then recreation, and then love. That cycle we'll see over here. Someone read number 3, which is from my book, the Book of Life, which explains this in a little more detail. Someone read that, number 3. Anyone?
I got to grab it real quick.
Thanks.
I can read it, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Avelut, mourning, is the foundation for Nechama, consolation. The word Avelut derives from the Hebrew word aval, which has a double meaning, definitive acceptance and, but however, used to transition from one idea to another, as in point A, but however, point B. When we go through the mourning process, we have both objectives in mind. First, to definitively accept the loss of a family member with the purpose of beginning to put the loss behind. And second, to transition, but however, into moving on with our lives. This first stage of definitive acceptance helps us achieve the second stage, transition, which naturally leads to the following stage of Nechama, a word with multiple related meanings, consolation, regret, changing one's mind, and changing the way one thinks in general. The stage of Nechama teaches us that the greatest consolation we can receive after the death of a loved one or a terrible loss is to use the experience as a vehicle for genuine change in our way of thinking. So Avelut, the experience of acceptance and transition, and Nechama, the process of changing one's mind, leads to teshuvah, which, as we explained in our discussion about Rosh Hashanah, is all about defining ourselves in our mind.
Thank you very much. So the first phase, according to what we're saying here, is the basis of Yom Kippur, which is teshuvah, which is changing changing the way one thinks, changing oneself and one, defining oneself in one's mind and going through the process of change is acceptance. So the concept of acceptance is vitally important to this process. And acceptance, I think, has four different levels. This first level is acceptance of loss, of failure. That's the way you change it. If you want to get into a successful relationship, change is vital. It's like that Broadway show they had. Says, I love you, you're perfect, now change. Right? So basically, people get into relationships, they love the person the way they are, and then they expect them to change. So the problem with that is that change is very hard. Change is very difficult. So the Torah is teaching us here, I think, that the concept of change comes through acceptance. Someone's able to accept failure and loss, they're able to move on to change. The second level of acceptance, phase two, which is so someone looks at number four. Basically, the Rambam, when he begins the laws of Tshuva, he starts it off by saying all the mitzvahs in the Torah, if a person transgressed one of them, when he does Tshuva and returns from the mitzvah, from a sin, he's obligated to confess before God. So this sentence, I always point out, is written it's like he doesn't know how to write a sentence structure. He writes the subject first, all the mitzvahs in the Torah. The person transgressed one of them. He should have said, the person transgressed one of the mitzvahs of the Torah. Why does he start off by saying all the mitzvahs of the Torah in an awkward fashion? And I think the reason is because the Rambam starts off the laws of Tshuva by telling us that there's a reality called all the mitzvahs of the Torah, all the laws of the Torah. It's a reality that we have to accept. And if we don't accept that reality, then there's nothing to talk about relationship. We can't have a relationship with God. You can't have a relationship with someone if you don't accept the terms of their agreement. It's like a joke I heard from, what's her name, Taylor Tomlinson. She's a great comedian. She's a very young comedian. She's up and coming. So she had a Netflix special. So on Netflix special, she had a joke, and I thought it was very poignant. She said she had a boyfriend, and the boyfriend wanted credit for I think she said he's with a Starbucks, and there was a girl there who gave him her number. So he tells his girlfriend, you know, she gave me my number, and I'm obviously not going to use it, but I want you to be aware. So she says, what are you trying to tell me? What message are you trying to tell me? She says, what wants is a swoon because you're willing to keep the basic tenets of our agreement, you know, of our relationship. So there's something called a basic relationship rules, right? And that's basically what we're talking about here. That the Rambam says that the first thing you have to know is that there's basic rules to a relationship, and you have to live up to that. And when we violate that, that's when we have to. That's one of the purposes of Yom Kippur. The purpose of Yom Kippur is to say that I want to. The word Kippur in Hebrew means kapara, means to wipe clean. So in order to wipe clean the sin and clean off our slate, there's an irrational, intellectual tshuva, in which we say to God, "Listen, God, I understand that you're the boss. You make the rules, and I violate those rules, and I acknowledge that." That's when we say vidui is one of the main prayers of Yom Kippur. Vidui means confession. We confess our sins. So there's an interesting halacha that basically says that if a person goes into a mikvah and he's holding a sheretz, an item that is not pure, so the mikvah won't help him. The Rambam says that's an analogy to saying a bidui, saying a confession, and not meaning what you said. So the question he asked the Rambam is very simple. Someone says a confession, they beat their chest, and they don't mean what they say. It's like they said nothing. It's like you're saying to God, mumbo jumbo. You don't mean what you say. It doesn't mean anything. So the Rambam should have said that it's like the analogy should be to someone going into a dry mikvah. There's no mikvah there. So, but he seems to say that there is a mikvah. There is something you're doing. In other words, when you say a vidoy and you don't mean it, you say a confession. You don't mean what you say. There is something you're doing. So what could it be that you're doing? So I always give the analogy to a person who got a speeding ticket. He goes in front of a judge, and the judge says to him, what are you going to say for yourself? So the person says, you know what? 55 miles an hour is the dumbest idea in the world. It should be 70 miles an hour. I went 65. The speed limit should have been 70 miles an hour. And it's ridiculous you have 55 miles an hour speed limit. The judge will throw him in jail. I mean, he'll throw the book at him. What do you mean you don't acknowledge that there's laws that... So really what happens, the judge knows what the guy's thinking. The judge knows the guy's thinking that's ridiculous. He says, judge, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean it. So the judge lets him off. Why? What, he knows he's thinking that. Why? Because he's saying to the judge said, is acknowledge, the guy's acknowledging that there's rules, there's law of the land, and he says the words. He says what he acknowledges with his words, even though the sentiments might not be there. Same thing with Vito. Vito, you're acknowledging to God that God's the boss. Just by saying the Vito, you're saying I know I got to get up and punch my chest. Strike my chest and say I did the wrong thing, even though I might not think it, even though it might not help me because I'm not thinking the right things. But just saying the words, acknowledging that God is the boss, is a significant act, and that's why the second level of acceptance is this idea that it's a rational idea. It's an idea that I accept God's rules, and when it comes to relationship, the same thing. I accept the fact that this rules to this relationship. And I will adhere to them. Now, that doesn't mean I'm emotionally involved yet. I'm not emotionally involved yet. But this is another level to Yom Kippur that teaches us about how acceptance can enhance relationship. That's just the basic acceptance of the fact that we're in a relationship, this means something. And there's rules to that relationship. Now, we get to the third level of acceptance. Third level of acceptance is... acceptance of your own vulnerability also has to do with failure. Basically, we as human beings are vulnerable. We have faults. We have failings. We're not perfect. That's the definition of human being. And Adam in the Garden of Eden basically put in our DNA by sinning with the eating from the fruit from the tree of knowledge. Good and evil, he basically injected into the world this concept of failure. Because we always explain that the Garden of Eden story happened during the 6 days of the creation. During the creation, it's not after the creation the story happened, it was during the creation. So inherently in creation there is failure. Therefore we fail, our frailties as human beings are inherent in our DNA. And this is what separates us from robots. Robots are, you know, they're quote unquote perfect. They do everything perfectly, but they don't have emotions. They don't have feelings. They can experience love. And that's what makes a human being human being. What makes a human being human being is the idea that I could fail, and I'm vulnerable. And if you think about it, vulnerability is really the building block of relationship. That's what the Torah says in many places. That the concept of erva arayot. Arayot means when a person violates relationship. The word ariel comes from the word erva. Erva means vulnerability. I mean, it's like, for instance, when Joseph said to his brothers that they were spying on Egypt, he says, etavatsa arts basam liros. You came to see the nakedness of the land. What do you mean nakedness of the land? The adultery of the land. What does that mean? It means you come to see where we're vulnerable and take advantage of us. The snake takes advantage of human beings. The snake is like a robot. Snake is has no feelings, no emotion. In the Garden of Eden, the snake says he was arom. Arom comes to the same word as erva, which is vulnerability, nakedness, arayot, which is adultery or sexual impropriety. So what is the fact that he was arom, which means cunning in English? What does that have to do with these other concepts? So it says, the verse right before says that Adam and Eve were arumim, they were naked. They were naked. Same word as arum, which is cunning. Because the snake was a being that knew how to take advantage of vulnerability. So what makes us human and not reptilian is the idea that we are vulnerable. And that's how we engage in relationships. Because when you're in a relationship, you're very vulnerable. you expose your feelings, you expose your nakedness, so to speak. Your faults are on display, and everyone sees everything bad about you in your personal life. It's very 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 complicated. That's what makes relationships so complicated. So the way they express it on Yom Kippur is the idea that we are desperate on Yom Kippur. God will forgive us on Yom Kippur, it says. That's another element. So there's an element called kapara, where God wipes clean, which is a more rational, intellectual atonement, so to speak. But then there's a level of forgiveness, which has to do with an emotional, that we have an emotional connection to God also. It's not just we accept the rules. We accept the fact that we are vulnerable human beings and that we fail. And that's what we're the whole Yom Kippur, as we're saying, we failed so many times. We failed our whole lives as a failure. We're beating our chest saying we did everything, things that are wrong. And when we do that, we're saying to God that we want you to accept us anyway. We did so many things that were wrong during the year. We want you to accept us the way we are. And that's why I think the Ne'ilah prayer and the Slichas on before Yom Kippur is so short. It should be longest. That the last prayer should be longest. The reason it's short is because it's teaching us that we want God to accept us. Even you say to God, "There's nothing I can say. There's only so much I can say. I'm sorry. I'm not perfect. Tomorrow morning I'm gonna sin again. I'm not perfect." That is an amazing level of vulnerability that we expose to ourselves to God on Yom Kippur, that basically telling God that we're vulnerable and we want Him to accept us, and that really enhances relationship incredible level. That's why if you look at number five, the mitzvah of the confession of Yom Kippur begins on the day's eve, before one eats the final meal, lest one choke to death on a meal before confessing. This is a famous halacha that we say the vidui before mincha on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So the way the Rambam says it's amazing. He says the mitzvah of the confession of Yom Kippur begins on the day's eve. That's like saying the mitzvah of Kiddush on Shabbos, it begins on Friday. How can you say Kiddush on Shabbos, Kiddush on Friday? So he says the mitzvah of the confession of Yom Kippur begins on the day's eve. That makes no sense. The only way that can make sense is if a person realizes that the essence of the vidu on Yom Kippur is not an intellectual vidu where we're just acknowledging the rules. We're doing much more than that. We're desperate to God. We need to get forgiven. We need God to. This is the last chance we have. This is the last day. Yom Kippur is the last chance. Rambam calls it Kates Mechilos Lichli. So this is the last chance that we have to get forgiveness from God. So the essence of this vidu is desperation. It's an emotional understanding that we're vulnerable. We really need God to forgive us because we care about God so much. We want a relationship with God that's meaningful. And we only can get that if God forgives us. And it means so much to us that we're desperate. And desperation calls for desperate measures. Therefore, the Rambam says that some crazy thing might happen. You might choke to death in a meal. What's the chance of you choking? There's one in a million chance you're going to choke to death in a meal. But because of that small chance, we don't want to take a chance. So the mitzvah of Vida Yom Kippur can be done on Erev Yom Kippur because it's the same. It's a Vida of desperation saying, I gotta say this Vida. So you could transcend time, so to speak, and say, I can do the mitzvah of Yom Kippur on Erev Yom Kippur because I'm saying, that's the whole essence of the Vida is desperation. This Vida is saying this Vida on Erev Yom Kippur. The reason I'm doing that is because of desperation. I might die. Even though there's a less than 1/1,000,000,000 chance I'm going to die, I still don't want to take a chance. That's the essence of Yom Kippur. That can be fulfilled every Yom Kippur because it shows desperation. That's what we're trying to show in Yom Kippur. And I think that's why the Rambam explains that there's so little chance that the person's judged on Yom Kippur is a benoni. And because what does it mean? What should I say? You're trying to say, even if there's a tiny chance that I don't know for sure about Tzedakah Rosh, maybe I'm a benoni. So the essence of Yom Kippur is that desperation, saying even if there's a tiny chance that this applies to me, I gotta go for it all. And when you do that, you're basically changing your whole outlook. As we said by Rosh Hashanah, that a person is not bound by his judgment on Rosh Hashanah by the merits demerits. You could change your whole Rosh Hashanah because on Yom Rosh Hashanah you could just say, I'm choosing to be a certain person now, even though the whole year last year I was a bum. I sinned much more than I did mitzvahs. But today I'm saying to myself, I'm overturning all that and saying, I want to be this a tzaddik. I want to be a righteous person. So Rosh Hashanah is a gift. It's not the last 10 days of the year, these 10 days. It's the first 10 days of the year because the last year is over. You can't change last year. Hashem says, if you celebrate Rosh Hashanah properly and you choose to be a certain type of person, you want to choose to be a tzaddik, you can overcome an entire year of action, because action is nothing compared to overall will. And the same thing with love, relationship with God. The whole year, you could define yourself as an evil person and someone who doesn't care about God. On Yom Kippur, you could say to God, I'm so desperate now to relate to you, to show you that I love you and I care about you and I want you to care about me in a kind of relationship, that I'm willing to do anything, whatever it takes. I'm willing to say vidui on Yom Kippur because I might die. I'm willing to give all my heart and soul to something, even though technically I know that there's a 1 in a million chance that this even applies to me. I'm still willing to do that. That's the third phase of acceptance. Acceptance of your own vulnerability, and we express that by the Yom Kippur being the end of forgiveness. The last phase, which is the most important phase, and the phase that I think we really need to take with us through the year in our relationships, is the acceptance of others when they are vulnerable. And that means that it's a mutual acceptance that happens on Yom Kippur. Someone wants to read a beautiful Gemara, someone wants to read number 6. It's also a quote from my book, but it's showing this amazing Gemara that I think is so fundamental for relationships.
So I can read it. Mm-hmm. If you can hear me.
Yeah.
According to the Talmud, after a wedding, a young couple would be greeted with the question, matzah or matzei, found or finding, a phrase based on 2 contradictory verses authored by the sagacious King Solomon. The first verse, written in Mishlei, Proverbs, states that one who is found matzah, a spouse, has found something wonderful. The second verse, written in the melancholy book of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, cynically states, I find motzei, marriage, to be more bitter than death. At first glance, this greeting seems to be asking the couple an appalling question. Are you happy with one another or are you miserable? The Talmud expresses no qualms about this greeting, but what could possibly justify such a crude query? And how could the astute King Solomon contradict himself so blatantly in his opinions about marriage?
Opinion expert.
However, it becomes clear that the greeting was not meant to be a question at all. It was actually a way of communicating subtle but sage advice from King Solomon about the key to a successful marriage. Surprisingly, the words matzah and motzei originate from the same root. The only difference is that matzah represents the past tense and means one who has found, but motzei is the present tense and means I find marriage. Therefore, the advice is as follows. Once you're married, if your attitude is that you've found the right person, meaning you have accepted your spouse regardless of faults, that attitude will lead to a happy union. However, if you persist in the process of finding out if your spouse is right for you, that attitude of non-acceptance will lead to a life of misery. During dating and courtship, it is quite sensible to consider the important qualities of your potential mate in order to give yourself the best shot at a happy marriage. However, once you've committed to someone special, it is vital to immediately shift focus from finding mode to found mode. Your partner must never feel that you are constantly monitoring and evaluating their worthiness. In the inimitable words of King Solomon, living under such scrutiny is a fate more bitter than death.
If you don't mind reading number 7 also, I know you read a lot, but this is important.
Okay. Oh, wait, I have to scroll down. Hold on a sec. We are instructed to seek out God when he is to be found, b'himatzo. As we mentioned, that phrase refers to what occurs during the 10 days of tshuva, which culminate in Yom Kippur. It is certainly no coincidence that this instruction uses the same root word, matzah, as the greeting to newlyweds in ancient Israel. The message is that we must not only seek out God at this time, but also acknowledge that we have found him.
So this is an interesting... amazing concept. Basically, the concept is you found the person. That means acceptance. You accept the person who they are. And in a sense, we'll see later that the Bradisha Rebbe used to say this to God. He used to say to God, I forgive you for all the things you did to me, if you forgive me for all the things I did to you, which is really, that's chutzpah. What he's saying to God is, he's saying, I found you. I'm accepting you. I accept you, even though this world is a terrible world of din, this world of difficulty and pain and suffering. I accept you because I know you really don't want to hurt anybody. You don't want to hurt me. You want my best. And the din, the strict justice of this world, the evilness of terrible things, this world is only meant for me to be able to express myself as an individual, to become an individual and express myself in our relationship. And if it was any other way, then it would be forced me. But I accept God for what he's done to me in the world, and I want God to accept me as an individual. And this is teaches we learn from relationship with human beings and our significant others. And basically the concept is that we accept someone for who they are and accept them despite their faults and their vulnerabilities. But the question was the last one is, well, what if the person has faults? You don't just accept someone's faults just for the sake of it. What about changing? What about changing for the other person? So I think that this concept needs to be expanded. And if you look at number 8, Pegavo, it says the love that is dependent on something when the thing ceases, the love also ceases. But a love that is not dependent on anything never ceases. So this sounds like basically saying that if it's dependent on something. So when the thing ceases, when that thing that's dependent on ceases, the love also ceases. But a love that's not dependent on anything never ceases. Now, this is a direct quote from the Mishnah, from an English translation that I got from the internet. What does it mean, a love that's not dependent on anything? If someone says to someone, I love you because you're beautiful, you're kind, you're generous, you're patient, you're giving. Whatever, all the qualities person has, you're beautiful, all different qualities person has. So the person loses all those things, then there's no one to love. What does it mean? Dependent, I love you for nothing. I love you. Saying better love is that never ceases, is not dependent on anything. What does that mean, not dependent on anything? That just doesn't make any sense. So this is a problem that I think people have with relationships, is that when you have it, this whole list of the things that you like about the person, that list diminishes over time. And it's like the song, we've lost that love and feeling. We lost love and feeling. How do you get back that love and feeling? It's very hard, because basically when you live with the person, you see all their faults. And the person you knew when you were dating is that same person you're married to, because when dating them, they were wonderful, but because you haven't lived with them yet. But when you live with them, you see, they're not so pretty, they're not so handsome, they're not so kind, they're not so giving. It's just inevitable. That's when no one's perfect. We have all vulnerabilities because we're not perfect people. So how do you overcome that? That's a challenge that everyone has in relationship. And this concept of matzimotze is the way you overcome it. And the way you overcome it is, look at the Rambam, as he says in Hilchos Tshuva at the end. It's amazing. The Rambam, it's absolutely amazing. He brings the laws of free will in the laws of Tshuva, which he says is the Amar Torah, is the foundation of the Torah. But he has a section called the foundations of the Torah. He should have put free will in the foundation of the Torah. Instead, he put free will in Hilchos Tshuva and laws of Tshuva. Because explaining Rosh Hashanah, the essence of Rosh Hashanah is to choose without sin, is to choose what kind of, do Tshuva without sin. Tshuva without sin means you're choosing the kind of person you want to be. Use your free will. So Tshuva has much more to do with free will than its foundation of the Torah. Similarly, the last chapter of Hilchos Tshuva, which I believe is Rambam's basic meaning of life, the last chapter, the 10th chapter, he brings the laws of avodah mi'ahava, out of serving God out of love. And he says over there in serving God out of love, he says, one serves God out of love, occupies himself in the Torah and the mitzvot, and walks in the paths of wisdom for no ulterior motive. Not because of fear that evil will occur, not in order to acquire benefit. Whether he does what is true because it is true, and ultimately good will come because of it. This is a very high level, which is not merited by every wise man. It is the level of patience of Abraham, who God described as he who loved me, for his service was only motivated by love. So he says that love is the bottom line of life. Loving God is bottom line of life. Serving God out of love is bottom line of life. This is the end of Hilchos Tshuva. So if you see, he says similar type of thing over here. No ulterior motive, not because of fear, not because of evil occur. Fear always means you're getting something out of it. Fear, he says, fear means you're getting reward or you're not getting punishment. You're getting something out of it. But he says love is no ulterior motive. No ulterior motive. Rather, he does what is true because it is true. And ultimately, good will come with us. What does it mean that he does true? What does it mean that no ulterior motive, loving out of no ulterior motive means you're doing the truth? What does truth have to do with love? What does it do with it? So I think the answer is that basically, when you love someone inherently for no ulterior motive, when you love someone for no reason, what that means is you love them because, instead of saying you love them because they're beautiful, they're kind, all these things, you love them because they were meant to be for you to be in time. They are soulmate. That changes everything. Basically, this is reality. This is true. This is the truth. When you love someone inherently, it means that they are your. They're your soulmate. This is who you're meant to be with from the beginning of time. That can never be broken. And that's just so much deeper than qualities that you like. Good qualities like is a wonderful thing. It's great to appreciate your spouse, great to appreciate the person you're with. But if you understand that this person was meant to be with me from the beginning of time, that's unbreakable. That's unconditional. Now, I always say, explain this, give a caveat. This doesn't mean if someone's abusive that you should just say, person meant to be for me. That's different. I'm talking about someone in a genuine relationship who the relationship is so this is why change is not a contradiction to acceptance. Acceptance means you set the person and the person just is a bum. You set the person because they're meant for you. And if feelings are mutual, you're going to try to be the best person you can for the other person because they're your soulmate. They're the person is meant to be from the beginning of time for you. And that's why this is unbreakable. And that's why it's called something dependent on anything. It's not dependent on anything external. It's an internal connection because it was meant to be. And you only can have this if you believe in God, you believe in meaning, you believe in I always explain to atheists. They always say, I say, you can't love your spouse if you're an atheist. You can't. Because love means that there's something meaningful about your relationship. Love means this person's special. This person's special to me. If you don't believe in God, you believe in atheism. You basically believe that everything's just, we're all just molecules. There's no meaningful molecule. There's no meaningful molecule. This is what the Rambam was saying here, that love is truth. Love, it means at the end of the day, love is truth. And that's what Yom Kippur is all about. Kippur is a day when we make ourselves vulnerable to God. God, in a sense, makes them vulnerable to us. He's saying, you should love me even though you have a very difficult life, even though life is complicated, life is painful, life is full of evil. But one day a year, we say to God, I accept you. I accept you because I love you and we're meant to be together, so to speak. My life is meaningful. My life is meant to be. And I was meant to be, in a sense, develop myself on Rosh Hashanah in order to choose relationship with God despite everything. I see the chesed through the din, so to speak. I see, that's what Akedah Yitzchak is Abraham, love God, saying that even though I don't understand why God's doing this to me, I still am carrying out because I know at the end of the day, it's going to work out. And that's basically the bottom line with Bitachon. When you trust God, he's saying, God, I don't understand why all this stuff, bad things are happening to me, but I know that you mean my best. I know you love me. I know you care about me. And when a person is able to do that, it's an incredible level of connection to God. And that's what we're doing on Kippur. It's a day we separate from life. And we say, you know what? Every day I live my life and I'm distracted. I can't really love you, God, the whole year. I can't. I just can't do it. But one day a year, I'm not eating, I'm not drinking, I'm not engaging in earthly pleasures. I'm just going to focus on you and say, look, this is the way I really feel deep down. The whole year, I'm just a jerk. You have to accept me. I'm going to say a short slicha. At the end of every Kippur, I say short, because I'm not going to be perfect. I'm going to sin as soon as Yom Kippur is over. I'm going to say a bracha without intention. I'm going to say something wrong. I'm a sin. I'm a bad. I'm a failure. I'm not perfect. So many things are wrong with me. But God, you're my soulmate. Accept me anyway. Accept me the way I am anyway. It's an incredible level of relationship, and we can apply that to our lives within our regular relationships. We can understand this. We can say to someone we care about, say, look, I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. But we accept each other anyway because we're meant to be with each other. We're not meant to be perfect. We're meant to be in a relationship that we care about one another. That's the main thing. And I think that this unconditional concept of unconditional love is a very powerful frame of mind for us to be in on Yom Kippur. We'll really change our experience of Yom Kippur and understand that our relationship with God is something that's really as real as our relationship with people that we care about in our lives. And that's always say that relationships with people in our lives that we care about is an analogy to God, and relationship with God is an analogy to people. Basically, one teaches about the other. And I think if we're able to do this, then we'll have a relationship that is unconditional. It's unbreakable. And that kind of relationship is something that, like I said, will teach us how to relate during the year and really enhance our lives to be able to live our lives to the fullest, which is the purpose of the this time of year. Because that's what we mean when we ask God for life. We ask God for to be alive, to not just be functional, and not just get through life depressed on a day-by-day basis where we're just doing things, we're accomplishing things that are just, at the end of the day, meaningless. It infuses meaning to every moment of our lives and makes our lives meaningful and something worth living. And if we do this, then that's what it means to be written in the Book of Life. Okay, we'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, please speak up. We're about to have a mincha. Oh, we're not doing it. So we have a couple minutes. So if anyone wants to ask any questions, please shoot. Anyone?
Rabbi?
Yes.
It's Marjorie. I guess the one thing that surprised me was right at the beginning when you said that the rarest thing is to be a Benoni. I'd always heard it the other way around, that very few people are completely evil, very few people are completely good, that most of us are Benoni.
So that's true. That's the Rambam is an interesting, I'm quoting the Rambam. What you're saying makes sense. It's logical. Because most people are sometimes are good, sometimes they're bad. The way the Rambam understands is amazing. The Rambam says it's dependent on, there's something called Rubo Kakulo. If there's a rove, for instance, if someone, if you have, like Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said about glycerin. Glycerin is made out of animals, but it doesn't have paste. This is a random example. So he says that normally things are batel b'shishim, 1 in 60. But when it comes to glycerin, it's batel b'rov. Same thing with kidney oil. Kidney oil is batel b'rov. Why? So this is a concept called Rubo Kakulo. And kashrus, we say this even by meat. The Rosh says this by meat. If three pieces of meat, two of them are kosher, one of them is treif, you can eat all three, according to the Rosh. Not everyone holds it, but the Rosh holds it. Why? Because Rubo Kakulo, once you have a majority, it's like the whole thing. So Ram says that's what happened in Sodom. Sodom was a province that was evil. Because it says Rabo Ras. It was majority of the people there were bad. That's why Avraham Avinu said, if it's tzaddikim, then you spare it. But since it was majority, 51%, that made it the whole thing evil. So Ram therefore says that if a person is sized up by God and there's a 51% on a slate bad and 49.9% good, he's considered to be an evil person, which is amazing. And that itself needs a lot of explanation, but that's what he says. He says, therefore, it has to be exactly 50-50 to be Benoni. And according to that logic, it's totally different from what we would assume. We would assume that a Benoni is someone who does good and bad all the time. No, he says, your majority, even by a sliver, you're completely righteous, completely evil. And the way I understand this is because the Rambam says later in that same parak about the shofar, he says, the shofar is supposed to wake you up and realize that if you do one action, you could tilt the whole world to the evil side or the good side. So basically, you have to look at yourself as if you're walking a tightrope. The world is 50-49-49, and what you do next is going to change the world. Now, that's ridiculous. How could a person live that way? They'll drive themselves crazy. The Rambam is saying, on Rosh Hashanah, you should think that way. Not that it's real, but you should think that way because you should realize your light, your choices matter. Rosh Hashanah makes a big difference. And even though it might not make that big difference in reality, but you have to feel that way. You feel as if it is, because that's how much of a difference Rosh Hashanah makes anyway. And I think the same thing with Yom Kippur. He says that even though there's a 1% chance, less than 1% chance that Yom Kippur is even relevant to you, you have to treat it as if it is, because you have to look at it as the tiny, tiniest percentage chance that is relevant to you. You have to care about that tiniest percentage chance. Now, I don't know if practically that means that he really means a beta or something else, but that's the words he says, is if it's a sliver more than 50%, then you're not a beta, or less 50%, you're not a beta. Does that understand what I'm saying? Margie?
Sure. Yes.
Does that make sense?
I find it troubling, but I understand what you're saying.
The Rambam is saying something very unique. It's still a question. What he's saying doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. But he's saying something very, the way I'm interpreting it, I think he's saying something very powerful. You know, you have to treat your life as if it's hanging in the balance, because your choices are that meaningful, even though it seems like it's not that meaningful.
Okay.
Anyone else? Questions? Anyone live? Live questions? Okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming. And Gemara Chasima Tov with everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi. Yeah.
Rabbi.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Chatzimah Tova.
Chatzimah Tova.